located at 7 Municipal, north of College in Edinburgh. Proud to be an independent family-owned business. Call 519-829-2444 or visit trocadero.ca.
Tune into Viejoteca every Tuesday from 6 to 8 p.m. on CFRU 93.3 on the FM dial or listen online at www.cfru.ca, Canada's number one salsa radio show. Vaya.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Open Source Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me is...
Scotty Hertz, waiting patiently for a week from now when it's the 40th anniversary of CFRU 93.3 FM at 250 watts of power. January 28th, 9th?
CFRU went sentient on January 28th.
1980. 40 years.
And then launched an attack on its enemies around the globe.
Exactly.
On January
29th. Actually, 46 years in this spot, but we'll get into that some other day.
Yeah, Radio Griffin. Look that up. Ask your kids about... Ask your parents about Radio Griffin.
Ask your parents about radio.
Oh, boy. Open Sources is CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show. We are here every Thursday at 5 p.m. to talk about the latest news items from Guelph, Ontario, Canada, and around the world. And we sometimes interview local newspapers and politicians, which this week will be Guelph MPP and Green Party of Ontario leader Mike Schreiner. Not sure what we're going to talk about. There's not much going on.
I like the fact you called it open mic. Like, that's just, it should be called. So, welcome to the open mic show.
Anyway, that's at the bottom of the hour. For the first half of the show, we're going to talk about some stuff from the past week, including the current state of labor relations with Ontario's teachers. How is that going now? Not great is the answer, but we'll get into that. But first, the impeachment trial of Donald John Trump got underway in the U.S. Senate this week, and it's really restored our belief in the values of discourse and oversight. It's quite remarkable just how people have come together to like really get to the bottom of this.
Yeah. By what was the word that's been dug up for the 19th century? Pettifogging? I saw that. I was like, I know what that means. Justice John Roberts was like, the pettifogging is on. Everybody's like, pettifogging starts to trend, hashtag.
John Roberts.
If you're not sure what pettifogging is, because it does sound weird, it means worrying about the minor details and unimportant things. And the whole thing is framed, I think. The back and forth, to and fro, tit for tat is pettifogging, like, high order.
Sounds like something Josie Vogels used to write about, but...
Oh, there's a flashback.
Deep cut.
Yeah. Should get Josie on.
I do wonder what she's doing these days.
Listening to this show.
Because she's not writing for Echo, that's for sure. Moving right along to the impeachment. Yeah, it's gone about as horribly as predicted. So to recap... the U.S. House of Representatives delivered the impeachment charges to the Senate last week. They were all sworn in.
They marched it along the hall, right?
Oh, yeah. It was quite the show. Yeah. And so the senators were sworn in by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, John Roberts. He swore them in as jurors. It is trial-like. So John Roberts is the judge. The... jury is the 100 or so, actually exactly 100 members of the U.S. Senate. And the prosecution are the House impeachment managers, so 7 Democratic congresspeople led by Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff. And the defense counsel is made up of some of your favorite TV lawyers, including Ken Starr and Alan Dershowitz.
Oh, boy.
Mostly being led by 2 fellows, Pat Cipollone, who is the White House counsel, and Jay Sekulow, who is Donald Trump's one of his personal attorneys. And so Tuesday, they get underway with the rules of the what the rules of the trial are going to look like. It was going to be 24 hours of arguments in 2 days, so two 12-day periods that would begin at 1 p.m. and end at 1 a.m. And actually, it's not even exactly 12 hours, because if there was a motion, or rather Mitch McConnell adjusted the motion to make it 8 hours over 3 days, but it's not like they don't go from 1 to 9 straight. They wrapped up at about 10 or 11 last night for the first full day.
And it sounds like to some bizarre old rules, they can't even have a coffee.
No, nope.
They can only drink water and milk.
Yep.
What is this, 1820 or something? I don't know. You can only drink water or milk in the Senate.
It's so stupid.
So it would sound like, and I haven't actually seen it in yet, that the sketch artist has taken to sketching senators that were falling asleep.
Mm-hmm.
Because I would take it the sketch artist, if they can't drink coffee, is probably falling asleep as well. So it does seem like a bit of a snooze. I watched the CNN 2-minute version. They're like, we watched all of this, so you don't have to. And I watched that, and that was like, I found it painful. I know some people find this, get a bit of a thrill. Have you watched any chunks of it? Or mm-hmm. just, yeah, and it's, what's your take? Is it like, is it the Watergate 2 everybody says it's it not, is? Is it's it not, really that interesting, or is it just like,
I don't think it's designed to be like binge watch, like, you know, so much Netflix shows. It's designed, like, if you're tuning in at a given time, you're getting the information. Like, they seem to be hitting certain points repeatedly, and that's sort of by design, so that, you know, because really this is about appealing to the TV audience. The people who are planning on voting, the people at home, people who might sit out, who think that this isn't a big deal. And
everybody looking for the bite. Right?
Right. And the point has been made in several places that, you know, there might be some Republican politicians in the Senate jury who may be hearing some of this stuff for the very first time, because they don't watch, you know, CNN or NBC, or they don't read the Washington Post.
They
read Breitbart, watch Fox, go to One American News Network and all these other places that, yeah, you know, that are in the pocket of supporting Donald Trump.
Certainly not listening to us.
So. No, of course not.
No.
But yeah, so that seems to be the kind of the design of it. The thing that makes me upset watching it isn't the process itself. It's the panels on CNN who come up, like, during the breaks. And I hear what you're saying, but there were a couple of people on CNN who were like, I'm so bored. They keep telling us things. And I was like, first of all, you're a political analysis analyst, so this should be, like, Shangri-La freaking law for you. And then the other side of the announcers was like, you got to watch what Mitt Romney's going to do and what Joni Ernst is going to do and, like, these quote-unquote moderates are going to do. And I'm like, yeah, I watched what they did on Tuesday, and they voted against every single last amendment to subpoena witnesses, to subpoena documents. And, you know, they acted like it was a big deal that Mitch McConnell relented at the last minute to expand it to 3 days of opening arguments instead of two, and to automatically input the House evidence instead of putting it to a vote first. It's the littlest things make people, you know, politely clap like it's a tennis match. And it's like
the pettifogging.
Pettifogging, because I'm sorry, all these brow furrers and pearl clutchers, Romney, Collins, Ernst.
How dare they?
Gardner.
How dare you?
Even somebody like Lamar Alexander, who's retiring. The time to send a message was Tuesday, to say, we want the whole enchilada. We want a real trial, not a show trial. We want to see all the evidence. If Jay Sekulow and his band of crash test dummies have actual evidence to produce, and not just lies. They did that in their testimony or their presentations before the Senate on Tuesday. Mm-hmm. Just lied in front of the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court and the whole United States Senate. Lied by saying that Republicans weren't allowed in the closed hearings. Republicans were allowed, saying that their Democrats didn't give Donald Trump a chance to rebut or cross-examine witnesses. Donald Trump's lawyers were invited to all that. They had every opportunity.
Mm-hmm. And Trump's not even in town, right? He's at the World Economic Forum.
Well, he's back now. But I think
he's back. That was fast.
I think he came back yesterday.
Tweeting on the plane that
he did? Which why he broke a record tweeting 142 times, because he was trapped on Air Force One and had nothing else
to
do.
They have good Wi-Fi on Air Force One, of course.
Well, yeah. We got
global.
Might have to launch a war from there.
Global Wi-Fi forever.
But yeah, and so, you know, watching some of these reporters, like, there's still a chance that, you know, Mitt Romney and Susan Collins and everybody could do the right thing. It's like, no chance. Tuesday was the time to set Mitch straight. And because I guess there was enough whining about not wanting to sit there for 12 hours, Mitch changed whatever little mind he had left. But I just want to say, if you're a reporter and you're still banking on these five or six Republicans to do the right thing, I want you to go and find your editor or producer, hand in your press credentials, go and find the nearest Scientology office, sign up, and sell Dianetics on the street corner, because you're just that gullible.
That is your reality. And Mitch McConnell, what was he? Was it last week he was saying that, oh, I'm totally in sync with the White House?
Yeah, he's been coordinating with the White House.
So it says, I mean, there goes one guy for sure who's he's not going to yield. There's all of this circus goes on. And it's not as if he's going to change his mind, but considering he's sort of steering the process as well, which is supposed to be impartial. That's the whole thing. Mm. I know that some people may not realize that we're calling it a trial, and it is a trial of a sort, but it's not a legal trial. It is different from that. The impeachment proceeding is a trial. I guess we could call it a political trial, right? It's not.
Well, it's political because it's happening in the Congress.
Trump gets impeached, which is looking unlikely, it's not like they're going to lock him up. They're going to. He will be removed from the presidency, and Mike Pence.
Well, this is the thing: the argument is like it's going to undo the election. It's like, well, what is Mike Pence? Chopped liver? Like, is Mike Pence?
He's a liver of a sort, I think.
Attached to the hip. Like, if you throw Trump out of the White House, Mike Pence has to go. No, but if you throw Donald Trump leaves the White House, Mike Pence becomes president of the United
States.
That's
the order of succession. And if Pence doesn't get it, it's Nancy Pelosi, isn't it? Isn't she third?
The Speaker of the House is third. And then I think it goes.
So it could get all weird.
Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense. But
it won't, because and most people don't think it's going to make go too far. But yeah, speaking of honesty, what was Trump's line? He's like, I'm honest. I make great, honest deals. And again, with the perfect phone call. I hear this every other day. There are actually two phone calls. The first one was perfect, and the second one was perfect. I'm like, who has described a phone call as perfect?
The language, the effect on the language of this presidency,
about?
From perfect phone call to exquisite intelligence.
Kofavi
to alternative facts. It's remarkable. It's just the other thing he said is like, honestly, we have all the material. They don't have the material, which is like basically saying like, well, yeah, they want this evidence to prove that we're bad and we got it.
And part of the reason might be why they don't have the material. Of course, they keep evoking the ghost of Clinton's trial. Clinton's impeachment, which was in 97, right?
99.
And was it? Oh, anyway.
Yeah. He was impeached in 98, but the trial didn't start until 99.
They turned over, 90,000 pages? But yeah. Trump blocking absolutely everything. The subpoenas being ignored. All the people.
And he hasn't even evoked executive privilege. He keeps threatening
but
there's been no evoking of executive privilege on any of this. There's just complete and utter fealty. Like, no, it's so mafia-like. We're just not going to, like, everybody's Johnny Tightlips.
We're just not going to give you that.
Johnny
Tight
Lips.
I'm not saying nothing.
Johnny Tight Lips. What should we tell your mom? Tell her to suck a lemon.
Tell your mother what I was asking for.
If he doesn't act like an innocent person, and none of them are acting innocent.
Tell me a bit about, because I don't know too much about him.
What?
Lev Parnas. I saw.
You mean one of the two Shreks?
Well, yeah. I didn't really want to say anything like that. But yeah, I mean, somebody had put out Trump is saying, I barely know this guy. And they put out all the photos with Lev Parnas with like every single notable and some not notable Republican.
Yeah, there's a Lev of the Month calendar coming.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. I'd never seen him. He's at this party, he's at that party. He's coming off the private jet with Giuliani.
Of pictures and videos of him with Trump. He has a picture with four out of the five Trump kids. Like, it's remarkable.
Uncle Lev.
Yeah, it seems like that.
Pretty much.
The whole Lev Parnas thing, which is like remarkable that he was kind of all over the media last week giving interviews. He was one of the two people who were arrested several months ago. They are associates of Rudy Giuliani, Lev, and Igor Fruman.
I hardly know them.
The proprietors of Fraud Incorporated.
Yeah. He knew them until he didn't know them.
Right. And they were basically doing the dirty work, the footwork. And, you know, it was revealed that through released documents that they were following around Marie Yovanovitch, who was the ambassador to the Ukraine.
Never met her.
Who they were desperately trying to get out of her ambassadorship because she's a person of principle and wasn't going to go along with a scheme. And that's another thing that came out around midnight on Tuesday. Was some redacted documents from the OMB, which is the Office of Management and Budget in the White House, which Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney runs, along with being the acting Chief of Staff for more than a year now.
Aren't all the Chiefs of Staff acting at this point? There's nothing permanent, right?
Blah, blah, blah. But it's but these show that on the day before the perfect phone call, they were already working towards stopping the money to go to the Ukraine. And then it reveals on September 11th, they were scrambling to release it. You know, like, right. they did nothing wrong. They were scrambling to release it as the investigation that the whistleblower.
Oh my God, they're coming. Just give them the money.
Right. It's, yeah, it's like that. And then on top of that, you have the indictment last week from the Intergovernmental Budget Office. I think that's what it's called. It said that basically the administration broke the law when it didn't release the funds to the Ukraine. So all this stuff together just makes it all the more sadder that, you know, Mitt Romney, who's the great hero of moderation and stuff, is you know, sitting on his hands instead of taking votes that are actually going to make a difference in this thing.
Ah, good old Mitt.
That they're going to sit by and. What kills me even more is that after it's over, they're still going to get points for being moderates, even though all they can do is furrow the brows and talk about how concerned they are. When opportunity knocks to do something about it, they'll do nothing, which is why it makes it all the more important that, you know, all these people should be fired in November by the voters.
Yeah, I guess it'll all change up if that happens. I wouldn't say if, it's more like when.
Well,
not completely, but there's always a turnover, right?
I like to think I can't be surprised by anything anymore, but
stay tuned.
Stay tuned.
Yeah. More on this, like, every week, no.
Well, maybe. At least next week, maybe, because that's when the administration presents its case. The Democrats have one more day tomorrow. I think they're still sitting tomorrow.
Right.
So Monday... Monday, you're going to see
Monday,
some
Monday, Monday. We're going to work on a bit.
yeah. Also working on a bit is Ontario's teachers. If you're listening to this on Thursday, you should know that the Elementary Teachers Federation of Ontario, teachers in Guelph, in the Upper Grand District School Board, will be taking part in a one-day strike on Tuesday the 28th. So hope you have plans for your kids that day. If you have kids in any Upper Grand District School Board elementary schools. But this is not getting better. It seems to be only getting worse. And if it seems like it's getting better over the next couple of weeks, it's only because high schools are in exams now. So there's not much labor action in the middle of exams.
No, and the teachers have called a pause to their... They're not going to screw the students on that, I guess.
Yeah.
Which is... to their credit, I suppose. But yeah, it's not going to – I don't know where this is going to go. I do know a couple of teachers. I was speaking to one, and I said, I'm kind of confused as to who's at when, why, and are the unions coordinating with each other? And he said a lot of the teachers are as confused, not as to why they're going out, but like when it is and who it is and why, which board and what the strategy – is for that, but I guess it's good to mix it up a bit and keep everybody on their toes. I suppose, you know, obviously a lot of parents kind of miff, but it sounds like, what was that poll? Was it an ECOS poll that said 57% of parents pretty
59.
Much? Oh, it's okay. So is that a typo or my European 7? I don't know. Back the unions. So there's that. That's something. I mean, it's, I don't know. Are a lot of them treating it as a snow day? I keep seeing all these ads for alternative things for the kids to do. I tell you, when we were on strike when I was 10, we just went out. It was like there was no programming. Programming was like going to the creek and looking for. It's not January. It wasn't January then.
Well, those were the days, but
I guess so. Latchkey kids, they don't exist anymore, do they? But anyway, listen to me, old man Hertz. In '79.
Save it for Saturday at 9 p.m. for Old Man Hertz.
Old Man Hertz could be a show. That might be better than G-Talk Nightly. Me griping about
anything
cell phones.
Better than G-Talk Nightly. I think the rotating strikes are hurting more than like if everybody went on strike at once, like the whole thing closed down. I understand the sort of confusion it begs, and it, like as someone who's like trying to stay on top of it, it's confusing to me too about like who's going out when and like only certain boards are going out at certain times. But speaking of the percentages on the poll results, I think it's been far more effective. It's not a thing where like you're taking where you're creating additional stress on every single parent in the province. But at the same time, a million kids in Ontario missed at least one day of school this week because of the strike action, and that's not small potatoes. Meanwhile, you have Stephen Lecce, who seems to. I imagine he's probably going to remain Minister of Education until this is done, and then there will be some kind of shuffle.
Sam Ustaf!
Sorry.
But Deputy gets... Oh, my goodness. Can you imagine that? You want to talk
Sam
about
Ustaf
the,
became a
you
Minister
You
want to
talk about
education?
The province collapsing.
But I mean,
they both, to me, seem underqualified, but like, more so junior.
Even
than,
the attempts to spin this... Progress exposed this Joe Warmington article about this, where he quoted this guy named Paul Greco, who was like, "I believe in Stephen Lecce and sticking it to these taxpayers. Just want to rip off the teachers. Want to rip off the taxpayers." And it's like, "Oh, that's interesting," because Paul Greco seems to go to a lot of Stephen Lecce's campaign events, and it's like, Warmington. Did you not think this could be like discovered in 6 seconds of Googling?
Or the picture of the random parent was a little bit. Was that in the Sun? And then it was like, turns out she's like a staunch supporter. And
can't
you
Warmington.
Just pay some protesters like they did for the Huawei trial? Just pay some people to be like, "Oh, I think Stephen is doing an
just
excellent job."
Just tell some kids that they're going to be in a music video and give them a painted sign and be done with it.
I watched a bit on Lecce to get, as we do, to get both sides, all sides. And they're back to that old same talking point thing. He says families a lot and taxpayer a lot. I think for some reason they don't like the Ontario Labour Relations Board because they keep bringing up this whole, well, we should get a private mediator. It's like, is it because you don't like the mediator, or is it, there's a well-established process, if people don't know, in the province, how this is all, and in labor in general, how it's all laid out, and the mediator is chosen, and I think they're like, well, we're having trouble getting the mediator, or mediators, because there is more than one, but I think the challenge is because there's, 11 unions, all total, something like that? Or 12. A QP is settled, right?
So QP is settled. But a QP is all support workers.
Yes, no, but it's still within the sphere, right?
It still
but
I had
to talk to the government.
That was also in October, too.
Yeah, but Lecce said that they used a private mediator, which I hadn't heard anything about.
Well, it's also a matter of,
I'm a QP member, by the way, and I'm like, I thought I would have heard something about this, but no, it's like, oh, that's done.
Right, but it's also a matter of not just, all teachers are represented by the OSSTF, like teachers in Guelph represented by the OSSTF are represented by District 18 of the OSSTF.
Yes.
So
there's districts.
It's not
and there's
easy
separate,
to coordinate all this. For
all
sure.
of the separate unions as well was OSSTF. ETFO's doing the rotational stuff too, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And where were the, you mentioned Guelph, but what are the other ones for next week? It was in
Well, Guelph. ETFO is next week.
If anybody's listening on our Monday
Elementary Teachers Federation of Ontario.
Rebroadcast.
Waterloo, just Upper Grand. Yeah, Waterloo is the same day, I think.
Keewatin.
Yeah.
And Penetang Protestant Separate, which is really interesting. They have a separate Protestant. It's the only one in the province.
Probably.
The separate Protestant school. They're going to be out. So Up in Power, fans in Penetang.
Because, everybody's following the OSSTF model, which is like we're going to have like 8 or 9 different boards at a time go out. And again, it seems to be working. The other thing is with the negotiations, it's like negotiating itself is tough. But the party line from Lecce is like it's still about wages. And like every teacher I've talked to
says something totally
different. It's not about wages. No. It's about class size. It's about this e-learning stuff. You know,
those are the main two. The mandatory learning, would we like class a
raise?
Sizes.
Yes, everybody wants a raise, but but that's not the primary issue. The primary issue is as Mark Burdine said in a Politico piece that I wrote this week, that you know it's about how they've lost 42 classes at the Wellington Catholic District School Board this year, 15 teachers, a couple of support workers. Kids are going to get lost in the shuffle because as a teacher now, you're not just – I don't think I put the exact quote in the piece, but he said, you know, it's not just about the whole Socratic method of teaching anymore where you get in front of a class and preach. You have to be on the lookout for the kids who are doing self-harm. You have to be on the lookout for kids who are, you know, struggling with learning disabilities. You have to be on the lookout for people who are going to cause problems. It, you know, you're as much a social worker as you are a teacher now in many public schools.
That component's always been there, but I think, you know, with the other – with cuts and reduced things in other places, then they are definitely seeing more of that for sure. Mm-hmm. And the what was it Ford was saying about his line about, well, you know, he's trying to have it both ways, though. Well, I have a real good respect for teachers, but their union leaders are terrible. Paraphrasing a bit there, but it's like.
It's like.
Really? You're going to go that way, dude? Like,
I love teachers, but like their unions are forcing them to do sleep. And again, I've talked to teachers and I said, you know, what about like the union? They're like. Yeah, the union's organizing us, but we wouldn't be out here if we didn't want to be out here.
Because they do get to choose.
Because it's freaking winter.
That's right.
Why don't you walk around all day in winter?
If the teachers were all happy, they wouldn't be out. They would vote no, we don't want to go on strike, and then they wouldn't. It's a really democratic process. I think they try and put this forward where it's like, oh, the big union bosses are dictating to these people what they should do. It's like, not at all. Mm-hmm. That is not at all the case.
Yeah, they closed Tammany Hall.
But yeah, exactly. Those days are over, kids. So
yeah,
but with the and Lecce makes it sound like every single teacher is on the sunshine list. Everyone's $90,000-$100,000. If I understand it right, the average is somewhere in the $80,000 range, which is really good. I mean, it is, but. He just makes it sound like everybody's on the sunshine list.
Well, the thing of it is,
and plumbers. And
when it comes to the e-learning thing, you keep grasping it like, well, this is how they do it in like Alabama and Arkansas. And you're like, do you know where Alabama and Arkansas sit on the list?
It's the basement, isn't it?
3 and 4.
Yeah.
They're 3 and 4 of the worst states for education in the United States.
Yeah.
And so
it's all charter schools and private and
plus there's UPay. Plus there's also a higher standard for teachers in Ontario, from what I understand, in terms of like getting your certification.
There are lots. They're always on courses.
Yeah,
they probably do like more certifications than lots of other industries where you just, you know, kind of do it once and do it for the rest of your life, right?
Yeah.
And you don't need to upgrade, but that's all I hear.
So it's
I'm taking a course, like, really?
It's
like,
terribly complicated.
You've got like a master's in education and you're still taking courses. Yes.
Yeah,
like,
then you go to teaching college and then you have to find a job. Like, you're not nobody's throwing money at you as soon as you leave university to go and teach in a school, which
is getting tougher because there's less opportunity, at least in Ontario. You can't go other places. And if you could go to Alabama where, I don't know, robots teach the kids or something, right?
But wow. We'll leave that there.
I think our guest is
going to have some opinions on teachers, and we will ask him about it. We're going to get Mike Schreiner on the phone, and we're going to come back right after this. You are listening to Open Source as Guelph. You're on CFRU, 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
Cross a picket line where workers' rights are enshrined.
That was by request.
Was it?
It was by request.
Okay.
It's not that we get requests often. You're welcome to send us a request, people, but Billy Bragg from his album The Internationale, and that was Never Cross a Picket Line. I believe that request might have been made by a teacher. I don't know. It's possible. We entertain them all, so.
Well, we also just like Billy Bragg.
Yes.
Because
I would call him a friend of the station.
Well, we do have his station IDs.
Yes.
So
we'll dig it up and play next week.
We'll dig it up somewhere. Yeah, I know. Well, the magic of Billy Bragg brought Mike Schreiner here in person. We were expecting him by telephone, but he was able to make it in, and we appreciate seeing Mike in person. So thank you for joining us, Mike.
It's great to be here. And I tell you what, one of my favorite Hillsides was when Billy Bragg was at Hillside. That was fantastic.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah. And no, he has been a regular at Hillside. Actually, did we record the tag at Hillside when he was at Hillside?
That is the first thing I ever recorded at this station. So that's.
But it wasn't at Hillside.
No. It was in a hotel in Toronto.
Well, there you go.
Cub reporter, Scotty Hertz.
Cub reporter, Scotty Hertz.
Little Mike.
Well, let's talk to this Mike since he's been so good to get here. We were just talking about the teachers, as you might have heard. I've been trying to ask the various teachers this, and they're not in this political sphere. They're just trying to do their jobs. But what it seems like is there are two different languages being spoken with the teachers. You have the teacher saying, we don't – give us a raise – sure, we'll take a raise, but what we're concerned about is the class sizes and the e-learning. And then you have Stephen Lecce and Doug Ford talking about, no, you want more money. What breaks this logjam? Because it seems there's no understanding between what the two sides want.
Yeah, I mean, they're almost like on two different planets in the way the conversation's going. And, the bottom line is, and teachers have made this very clear from the beginning, is they're standing up for high-quality public education. They don't want to see an increase in the average class sizes, and they don't want to see mandatory e-learning. That's the bottom line. They're also upset, by the way, that the province passed legislation imposing a 1% increase without negotiating at the bargaining table. You know, I think that conversation may have been there if the province had actually bargained in good faith instead of bringing in the legislation ahead of time. Mm. That poisoned the well. Here's the bottom line is we're already seeing cutbacks in courses available to students, cutbacks to programs, just going from an average class size of 22 to 22.5. Imagine what it will look like if we go to 25 or 28. That's just not a viable option if we're talking about high-quality education. And when it comes to mandatory e-learning, they're looking at places like Alabama as their model. I'm sorry. You know what? I think Ontario's competitive advantage is we have a highly skilled, highly educated workforce. You know, I don't think Alabama is our comparator. At least it's not my comparator when it comes to quality education. So what this is really about is, you know, are we going to invest in education? What I find so ironic is some of the programs that are being cut back due to the average class size increases are programs in the trades because a lot of those courses require, you know, much smaller class sizes. So the province is launching this ad campaign to encourage more people to go into the trades, which I support. That's the right thing to do. And I agree with the government on that. But what I don't agree with is actually cutting the programs where we educate people with the trades in our schools. It makes absolutely no sense.
Yeah. And there are only so many slots in the trades classes too, like in your wood shops and your electrical shops. And so there are a lot of students who, you know, maybe have to pick up a course in order to make that application to go to college and who are being left out into the cold right now.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, so, you know, from my perspective, this is what a lot of people don't understand is they say, oh, well, you know, 25 students in the classroom, what's the big deal?
Right.
But it's an average class size. Yeah. So if you're going to have 10 students in the shop class, for example, you might have 35, 40 students in the English class or the math class. Yeah. And so that's when it starts becoming unsustainable in terms of just to be able to deliver high quality education. And then you put on top of that students with special needs and other issues like that, like we're having numerous reports coming out now around increasing levels of violence in the classroom, for example.
Yeah.
So teachers are having to deal with a lot of other issues, and taking more adults out of our schools is the wrong way to go.
Does the matrix on this change when the legislature gets back in session? Because a lot of this has happened since the legislature has rose for the holidays and you guys don't get back till after Family Day.
Right.
Does taking the pounding from the opposition critics like you help move things along? Do you think that's going to be a process here?
Well, I certainly anticipate that all three of the opposition parties are going to ramp up the volume on this once we get back in February. But you know what? I've been out putting pressure on the government, in the interim now. So I've visited, most of the picket lines here in Guelph, obviously, but in other locations as well.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? I tell you what, for those of your listeners who are part of the public who haven't been out on a picket line, it is cold out there right now.
Yeah.
You know, so doing a four-hour shift, I was at Bishop Mac the other day, and the wind coming down Clare, it was cold. And, you know, that takes a lot of dedication to go out there and walk back and forth on that cold sidewalk, you know, advocating for public education. And so, you know, I think, you know, I don't think most of those teachers want to be out there freezing. They want to be in the classroom with students.
Yeah. I was at Lord's, and it's not like like Westmont isn't a major thoroughfare, mm-hmm. but there was some clearing, but you know, marching up and down between the big snowbanks too,
yeah, exactly.
was not,
yeah.
not the most fun in the world. We have had other news lately, so I do want to touch on other things, but the appointments to the Human Rights Commission. Weren't we past this? Weren't we past the cool guy on Instagram getting government appointments?
You know what? You would have thought the premier had learned, but I guess not. Like, he just can't get away from appointing unqualified people, you know, friends and cronies to various positions. Mm-hmm. You know, I still can't believe I'm the person saying we should have merit-based appointments. Like, so I put out a whole 8-point plan around reforming the appointments process. I got a lot of publicity in the summer, even oftentimes from conservative media as well, because it's just looking at what are the best practices around the country and around the world to ensure that we have an appointments process that gets away from this type of cronyism. Mm. And, you know, it's unacceptable. And I would have thought the Ford government had learned given the crisis they faced last summer.
Yeah.
But it continues, unfortunately.
Yeah. And I don't want to assign sinister motives to the person who runs the province because, you know, Doug Ford has spent most of his life in business, which is very much like handshakes. And I trust you. I know you. And, you know, so, I mean, that's how that works in a lot of business, like glad handing. And it just seems like maybe there's a learning curve that, you know, it's just like, oh, here's two positions open that I have to confirm. And, you know, it's just part of his, you know, mindset as a business person that, you know, just put people in there that, you know, it doesn't matter about the government processes. I know this is a good guy, so.
Well, I don't know, Adam. I ran businesses, and when I was running my businesses, we would publicly post a position. People would apply, and we would interview applicants, and we would make a decision based on who was the most qualified applicant. To me, that's good business practice. So
yeah.
I would even argue, like, you're not a good business operator if you're not appointing people who are qualified to fill the position. And here's the thing I've been saying all along is that the premier has every right to appoint people who are aligned from a vision, ideology, political standpoint with the government's agenda. Well, yeah. I don't think anyone expects them to appoint people who, you know, are going to actively try to sabotage the government's agenda.
Yeah.
But the bottom line is they have to be qualified. It has to be merit-based. There can't be cronyism involved. And so that's the kinds of reforms we're looking at. We're not saying, you know, you can't appoint somebody who, you know, is philosophically aligned with you, but it's got to be done through a fair, open, transparent process, and it needs to be merit-based.
Mm-hmm. I know this is probably going to be a big issue for you because it is touching on environmental stuff, but it's also touching on, you know, people coming to and from Toronto, the cancellation of the Presto, the transfer mm-hmm. discount. Has this been like, have you been hearing whispers about this? Has this been like in the shadows of Queen's Park? Like, where did this, do you know where this came from?
So I'd been hearing some whispers about it. I've actively come out and opposed it, obviously. We should be making transit more affordable, not less affordable. This particularly hurts. So this is more than an environmental issue.
Mm.
This is a social justice issue because it particularly hurts low-income workers who can't afford to live in Toronto.
Mm.
So they have to live outside of Toronto and commute into Toronto. And so I've heard some commentators say, oh, an extra $1.50, really, does it really matter? For a lot of low-income workers, an extra $1.50 every single day, that's huge money.
Yeah.
And so, you know, not only are we making it less affordable for people to choose transit as an option when we want to get people out of their cars and onto transit, but it's a social justice issue in terms of, you know, low-income or low-wage workers being able to have a place where they can afford to live and still be able to commute to work in an affordable way.
And it's I can't remember if it's a point you made or somebody else that I was reading, but you know it's still part of the same trip, right? When you get
totally
off the
same
train
trip.
And get on the subway, it's you know you're
when
still,
I go into Toronto by GO, you know I oftentimes go to Union Station and then I take the subway up to Queen's Park.
Yeah,
That's the same trip.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, it's the same thing that really angers me sometimes when I take GO and I have to get off at like Mount Pleasant or something and take the GO off the train and take the GO bus. I get charged extra for that as well, which is another thing GO needs to work on. I have to pay more for less convenient trans. I mean, now that we've expanded the number of trips in and out of Toronto via the train, that's a little less of an issue, but that was always an irritant for me as well.
I want to talk about another irritant, which is giving credit where credit is due, because you were here last Thursday, not here at the station, but here in Guelph when they announced the money for electrified buses and for building the new barn and all that. And I know you were at the announcement before the holidays about the new integrated health network here in Guelph. Is it hard when the government does something right for you to maybe put critical things aside and give credit where credit is due? And, you know, we this goes into, you know, how partisan we are and how everybody sort of pick their teams. And is how do you cope with that?
Not hard at all.
Not hard at all.
When the government's going to do something good for Guelph, I'm here to give the government compliments. So when they put money into U of G, I think the headline was Mike and Mike's funding announcement, Mike Harris and Mike Schreiner. I told Mike Harris, you can come to Guelph and put money into Guelph anytime you want. I'll make sure I give you positive press. Stephen Crawford was here, the parliamentary assistant for the transportation, to infrastructure for the transportation announcement. And, you know, MPP Crawford and I did a video together with Mayor Guthrie. And I was happy to do that. A few people said to me, I got a little criticism from some of the other parties saying, why are you doing a video with the conservative government saying nice things about them? I'm going, they just put a whole bunch of money into Guelph so we can electrify our transportation system, which is actually going to help us save money and help us achieve our climate goals. I'm willing to work with any party, conservative, liberal, NDP, whatever party, if it's going to be good for Guelph and, you know, advance the vision I have for this province. And so I think we need more of that working across party lines. I mean, I was happy to co-sponsor a bill with MPP Lauren Coe that was actually passed third reading and is now law in Ontario that if you, you know, block an EV charging station, you're going to receive a $125 fine. And I received some criticism around that for why would you work with the Conservatives? I'm like, a lot of EV drivers, including some city councilors here in Guelph who drive EVs, have said this is a huge issue. So if this is going to help, you know, electric vehicle drivers, which is an important part of meeting our climate objectives, I'm willing to work across party lines to make that happen.
Does it make your life easier, like showing that you like that willingness to work together? Because, you know, it's been noted you are a constituency or a caucus of one.
Yes.
You know, you sit all alone up there in the corner. I'm just just jerking your chain. But, you know, you have to work extra harder because you don't have the caucus. You don't have that party apparatus behind you. But you have to prove yourself every day in a way that maybe Andrea Horvath doesn't or John Fraser doesn't. Does the squeaky wheel get the grease?
Absolutely. I'm happy to work hard for Guelph. I love this job. And you know what? I will happily take criticism from anyone who is going to criticize me for working across party lines to do something for my community. Mm-hmm. Like, I got elected to do things for Guelph. I got elected to put forward a vision. And, you know, like, my three priorities, which I've been talking about a lot right now, is, you know, how do we embrace a clean and caring economy to help us address the climate crisis? We need more investment in mental health and addictions. I was happy to bring Minister Tobolo to Guelph in December, and he's coming back again in February to talk about how we can invest more in mental health and addiction services in Guelph. Housing's another huge issue for me. Happy to work across party lines and all three levels of government, actually. So the mayor and MP Longfield and I all have a good working relationship. And I think that's what people expect. Mm. And so what I keep telling people is I can walk and chew gum at the same time. I can criticize the government on this issue where they deserve to be criticized. And a half hour later, I can compliment them if they deserve to be complimented. Mm-hmm. And I'm not afraid to do that because I think people are sick of the hyper-partisanship and the toxicity that brings to our politics and to our government.
Mm-hmm. I do want to, since you're here, and I've been seeing a lot on social media lately, anytime I see a news story pop up about a new development starting or a lot of city money going to some initiative, inevitably someone pops up and says, we should be putting money in a new hospital. Now, for people who may not know, that is provincial jurisdiction,
it
but
is.
Where a hospital is built, where? Are you participating in any sort of advocacy, or is there any sort of push from the community that, because it is your jurisdiction?
That's right.
About, you know, looking at what Guelph needs in terms of hospital needs.
So we're looking at short and long term. So short term, we're looking at expanding the footprint of the existing hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are proposals on the table that are moving forward in that regard. You can go and even see some of the construction work happening. Obviously, we're going to need another larger facility as the city continues to grow. And so that's a longer term solution. So I'm advocating for both short term and long term. There's also some solutions that we can come up with to start taking pressure off of Guelph General. One is more long-term care beds in Guelph. I'm actively pushing some proposals that are on the minister's desk right now, as well as some that people have approached me about who want to get a proposal on the minister's desk. Because one of the challenges is you have people who are in hospital who should really be in a long-term care or an alternative level of care,
right,
but none of those beds are available. So if you can make more of those beds available, it helps take pressure off of Guelph General. The other one is more funding for mental health and addictions. Mm-hmm. We have a number of people who go through the emergency room and are only going to Guelph General because they're not able to access mental health services or addiction services in the community.
Right.
So that's exactly why I'm having the minister back here in Guelph to talk about how we can make more investments in that regard. And then the final one is primary health care reform. And I love to say the Guelph Family Health team is very active on this file, working with Guelph General and Community Health Center and other health practitioners to make sure more primary care services are available, because sometimes people end up going to Guelph General because they can't access their primary care health
right.
provider. And if they could, that would also take pressure off hospital as well. And so those are part of those shorter-term solutions that we're looking to deliver.
Mm-hmm. It just seems to me that maybe it's a communications thing that, you know, a lot of people are expecting big things. And when you talk about what can be done, it's a matter of, you know, what can be done, not a matter of building that big thing, building the big hospital, because I think that that's sort of what people are expecting.
Yeah, I think we need both.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm saying is, and that's what the hospital's saying.
Yeah.
And so I take my cue from the healthcare providers here in Guelph of what is needed.
Mm-hmm.
And I go to Queen's Park and advocate for that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why we have to, I think, take a two-track solution. It's
right.
like we have to have the longer-term solution, which is the bigger, bolder, we need a new facility, and we need to take the short-term solutions that let's expand the existing footprint, and let's look at these other investments in community care to take pressure off hospital.
We were talking about whispers a couple of minutes ago, so I want to get back to whispers. I know that the government's collecting feedback on the budget now.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine you have your own feedback about the budget. So I guess, first of all, what are you hoping for from, you know, for Guelph, for yourself, for, you know, for the province in this budget? And then what are you hearing and that's maybe making you concerned?
Well, I mean, the biggest thing that concerns me right now is that according to the Financial Accountability Officer, there's $5.3 billion of unannounced cuts that we're likely going to see in this budget or the next budget. And so that has me deeply concerned. Well, where are those cuts coming from and how that's going to affect our community and communities across Ontario? I mean, it's not just Guelph that's feeling the pinch. It's everyone's feeling it. And so that's a big concern of mine. So the thing I've been really pushing the government to do is to deal with the fact that Ontario has the lowest per capita spending of any province in the country and the lowest per capita revenue of any province in the country.
Mm.
So we need to look at ways that we can be more efficient in spending money and save money. The thing I've been critical of is let's get rid of the Liberal government's, I call it the unfair hydro program.
Mm-hmm.
We're subsidizing electricity prices at a tune of $4.2 billion a year.
Mm-hmm.
So the $7.4 billion deficit, over half, $4.2 billion, is to be the only jurisdiction in North America to subsidize electricity prices. The Conservatives campaigned against it when they were in opposition, and now they've kept it and say we have this huge budget deficit problem Well, that's the big chunk of the problem. So if we would fix that, we could avoid these cuts to healthcare, education, social services, et cetera. And then we need to look at the revenue side of things. We have the lowest per capita revenue for resources of any province in the country, even though we're the largest mining jurisdiction in Ontario. So if we could be looking at how do we increase revenue from things like resource royalty rates, that would be a way to increase money we have available to address the deficit and to fund essential public services without increasing the tax burden on people with modest and middle incomes. Mm-hmm. So it's that kind of thinking that I'm hoping to see in the budget. And then the final point is most of the budget cuts in the government's first budget really targeted the most vulnerable in our society.
Mm-hmm.
And we simply can't download the deficit onto the most vulnerable in our community. And so I'm deeply concerned about changes, for example, to the definition of disability, which would restrict access to Ontario Disability Support Payments, which would be devastating for a number of individuals who are struggling in our community.
I remember when you came on after the budget was announced last year, we talked about the concerns that it was a pre-election budget, although it was for the federal election, that maybe there would be a bit more freedom to put it a certain way for the Ford government to be as bad as it wanted to be, let's say. Do you think that's still a concern?
Well, that's where the $5.3 billion in unannounced or unidentified cuts has me deeply concerned, where that's going to come from. And did they delay that until after the federal election? That's pure speculation.
Right.
So I don't know, but I can tell you the $5.3 billion number has been documented by the Financial Accountability Officer, who's an independent officer of the legislature. So I'm deeply concerned about that. I'm hoping the government learns from the mistakes they've made, on the autism file with funding for municipalities, the retroactive cuts, the cuts to public health, et cetera. I'm hoping they've learned from the backlash from the public and that they backtrack on these unidentified cuts.
Aside from the budget, I imagine you have goals this year. What are some of your goals looking forward to the year ahead?
Yeah, I'm hoping we can convince, my reservation, that we can convince this government that embracing the clean and caring economy not only is beneficial to Ontario's economy and job creation, but will help us address the climate crisis that we're facing. I'm hoping that 2019, with the fires in Australia and the Arctic and the 100-year floods we're having in Ontario, the $150 billion in costs, according to the insurance industry, that climate change cost the world last year. I'm hoping 2019 was the year we woke up to this crisis and that 2020 is the year we start embracing it. And I think that'll benefit Ontario's economy. If you look at where global capital flows are going, they're going into the clean economy. I want that money invested, or a chunk of that money invested, in Ontario, specifically Guelph, obviously, so we can create jobs and address the climate crisis. The other big one for me is we have to address the mental health and addictions crisis. And that's going to take investment in expanding services for people. 12,000 young people on a waiting list to access mental health services is unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
And so we need to address this. And then the big one, too, is the housing affordability. Everywhere I go in Guelph and across the province, and we're talking urban and rural communities, people are talking about housing affordability. Matter of fact, I was just at ROMA, the Rural Ontario Municipal Association, last week. I had a number of delegations, and I had counselors saying that businesses, particularly in smaller communities, are literally buying houses to rent to their employees because they're having trouble attracting workers because they can't afford to live in the community. Mm. And so, that's a huge issue.
Yeah.
And obviously in Guelph, we know housing affordability is at crisis levels. And so we currently right now have a discussion paper around developing a comprehensive set of solutions around housing affordability. And so I'm going to be pushing that, but also working with other levels of government, again, on some shorter, more immediate, short-term solutions as well.
Periscope Marine Conservation Act?
It's still on the list. Absolutely.
Still on the list?
Absolutely. I'm hoping to get it through committee. A number of municipalities have passed resolutions in support of it. So obviously the city of Guelph did, but we're seeing municipalities all throughout the region who have passed resolutions supporting it. I'm hoping that continues to put pressure on the government to bring it through committee.
All right. We will see. Mike Schreiner, thank you so much for taking the time today. And we'll see you again soon.
My pleasure. Happy to come on anytime.
All right. We'll hold you to that.
Or else.
That's it for this week's show. Leanne Piper, Ward 5 Councilor, will be on next week. And until then, you can find us on our website, opensourcesguelph.com, or on Facebook at Open Sources Newswire, and on Twitter at @OS_Guelph. If you'd like to listen to the show again, you can download it from our website every Monday, or at the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, or on your favorite podcast app, like Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or you can check out my news and politics site at guelphpolitico.ca.
Scotty Hertz on Facebook, Scotty Hertz on Twitter, and I blog at spannerbook.wordpress.com.
And we got to get out of here for DJ Sounds Good to Me, who's here at the top of the hour here on CFRU, 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And as you heard earlier, we will be back next Thursday at 5 p.m. for more Open Sources, and we will see you then.